Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 14th of June, these are our main stories. Nearly 80 people have drowned in the latest migrant boat disaster off the coast of Greece. The European Parliament has approved a groundbreaking voluntary code of conduct to regulate artificial intelligence. An Australian senator accuses a male colleague of sexual assault during a tense exchange in Parliament. Also in this podcast, the man who introduced the world to whale song. We look back on the life of marine biologist Roger Payne. The number of dead has been steadily climbing all day from Greece's deadliest shipwreck this year. As we record this podcast, at least 78 people are known to have drowned after their overloaded boat capsized off the coast of Greece. The vessel, packed with migrants, was reportedly bound for Italy. Coast Guards did manage to rescue more than 100 of those on board, but many more are still missing as the search operation continues. Poignantly, it seems that some of those on the ship refused an earlier offer of help from the Coast Guard. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, gave us this update.
Well, it looks like this boat probably set off from Tobruk, a port in Libya, heading for Italy. And with migrants aboard, we think, from Egypt, Syria and Pakistan. As you said, so horribly ironic that this boat was actually spotted on Tuesday by Coast Guards, who could see that it was overloaded. They also say they could see that no one on board had life jackets and indeed offered help. We don't know, of course, whether it was the passengers who said they didn't want help or the crew. The crew, of course, perhaps wanting to make sure they got paid for landing their human cargo. Either way, they refused help, and only a few hours later the boat capsized and a rescue effort was launched. The problem is that it looks like, from the estimates, there were about 400 on board. So by my calculation, that could mean there are 250 people still missing in the middle of the ocean. The death toll could be very high indeed.
So a huge loss of life. How common are tragedies like this?
Horribly common, I'm afraid. I mean, mass drownings like this do make the news, but they happen all the time, which makes it hard to estimate because small boats set off and sink. Nobody knows about it. The people smugglers responsible certainly hide this. It's not in the interest of their business for people to know the risks. We have confirmed that last year 2,700 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean. The figure has been higher. At one point it was 5,000. There is some evidence it may be getting higher in that part of the Mediterranean where this boat sank. That's because migrants traditionally went from Turkey to Greece overland. There's some suggestion that the Greek authorities have been pushing them back. It may mean that more people are attempting the journey by boat, which is, of course, far more dangerous.
Yes, as one route gets closed off, another one opens up. So what can Greece and other countries do to stop boats setting off on these dangerous journeys?
Well, only last week, the European Union agreed a new deal in which they said countries, it would make it easier for countries to deport migrants. They could send them back to countries which the migrants passed through along the way. They're also considering, they were at the moment giving money to Libya, which is supposed to stop migrants leaving. They're considering a similar deal with Tunisia at the moment. The trouble is, this boat seems to have set off from Libya, which suggests methods like this don't work. There are conflicts in the world, there are economic hardship places. This means that the challenge of stopping migrants really can't easily be solved.
Paul Moss, the European Parliament has voted in favour of a new code of conduct to regulate artificial intelligence, the first such legislation in the world. Ahead of the vote, the EU Commission's Vice President, Margrethe Vestager, told the BBC that the greatest risk from advanced AI was discrimination rather than the end of humanity. She was speaking to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
The choice is to look at how artificial intelligence is being used. If it's a customer service robot, I want to know that I'm not talking to a human being, but what are the risks? If it's a bank, using it to decide whether I can get a mortgage or not, or if it's the social services of your municipality, then you want to make sure that you're not being discriminated. because of your gender or your color or your postal code where you live. You want to be seen as who you are. And I think that is a very solid approach, because those guardrails, they also were important in the non-digital world.
Is there a clear line of responsibility here? You know, is it possible that OpenAI could turn around and say, well, we've released ChatGPT, you know, we can't be responsible for somebody using it to decide somebody's mortgage?
Well, there must be a relationship between developers and those who uses the technology to make sure that if you release it and say it's perfectly fine, it will not discriminate anyone, that the user cannot then, you know, just twist it and say, well, yeah, but in the real world, we only want to lend to men. That cannot be the case. Before the legal obligations comes into force, we are trying to do sort of a broader international voluntary AI code of conduct.
Do you think we should be talking more to China?
I think we should be talking more to one another. So I think first things first, a consensus among like-minded. And then I think also down the road, we'll need to take, of course, many more jurisdictions on board, and eventually also to have a United Nations response.
That doesn't sound to me like anybody's going to be pausing AI anytime soon, like some of the experts have recommended.
You know, sometimes one can have that, oh my God, couldn't we just stop the world just a bit? I don't think that it is realistic.
What do you think is the biggest threat that AI poses?
I have listened a lot to those who said that there is a threat of extinction. Probably that may exist, but I think the likelihood is quite small. I think the AI risks are more that people will be discriminated. They will not be seen as who they are. AI will be everywhere, in everything we do. You know, your hairdresser will use AI to suggest you another way of doing your hair.
I look forward to that.
For the farmer, there will be AI to give advice. Is it today you should harvest or should you wait a bit? It will be pervasive.
The EU's competition chief, Margrethe Vestager, speaking to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. Australian politics has again been rocked by allegations of sexual misconduct. During a parliamentary debate, a senator, Lydia Thorpe, accused a colleague of harassment and sexual assault, an allegation he strenuously denied.
This person,
Senator Thorpe, I would just warn you at this point,
sexually assaulted me,
Senator Thorpe,
and the Prime Minister had to remove him from his office.
Senator
and to
Thorpe,
have him talking about this today is an absolute disgrace.
Ms. Thorpe later withdrew the allegations in order to comply with Senate rules, but she said she would be making further comment on Thursday. A correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, told us more about the altercation in Parliament.
This was a debate in Australia's upper parliamentary chamber, the Senate, about a report on sex discrimination and respect in Parliament when these explosive allegations were made by the independent Senator Lydia Thorpe, who accused a Conservative lawmaker of sexual assault. Now, she made these allegations under parliamentary privilege, and the allegations were made against the Liberal Party Senator David Vann, who immediately denied the accusation, saying that he rejected Senator Thorpe's disgusting statement outright. Later, Senator Vann issued another statement saying that he'd contacted his lawyers and the allegations against him were unfounded, completely untrue, malicious and despicable.
So what can be done about this?
Well, at the moment, we don't know if any complaint has been made to the police. What we do know is that this explosive matter, has been referred to the President of the Australian Senate. Senator Thorpe did say earlier this year that she had been sexually harassed and assaulted at Parliament House in Canberra, but she didn't give any specifics. She didn't identify the alleged perpetrator until today, so we don't know too much about the nature of the allegation, when it took place or what happens next. But safe to say, given the very serious nature of these accusations, there is likely to be a great deal of follow-up in the days to come here in Australia.
And this all comes in the wake of other allegations of sexual harassment and bullying in the Australian Parliament and in government.
You're right. This isn't the first time that federal politics in Canberra has been engulfed by claims of toxic behaviour. There were allegations in 2019 that a political staff member had been raped by a colleague in a ministerial office. Those allegations were strenuously denied. There were broader concerns about sexist bullying and misogyny in federal parliament. And for those of you with longer memories, back in October 2012, there was perhaps one of the most memorable speeches in Australia's federal parliament when Australia's first and only female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, gave a very memorable speech on misogyny. Now, for many people, those words of Ms. Gillard more than a decade ago are as relevant today as they were all those years ago.
Phil Mercer, more than a week after Ukraine finally launched its long-trailed counteroffensive, there has been a relatively rare Russian attack on the Black Sea port of Odessa. Three civilians were killed and several others injured after Russian missiles hit the Ukrainian city, setting a warehouse on fire. And three more civilians were also killed in the eastern Donetsk region. Meanwhile, President Putin claims the counteroffensive is failing, even as Ukraine insists that it's making progress. We heard more about the attack on Odessa from our correspondent in Kyiv, Myeni Jones.
According to Ukrainian authorities, four missiles were launched from a Russian ship on the Black Sea towards Odessa overnight. They were able to stop two of them with their air defense system, but other two struck the city, struck this area that had a business center, an educational complex, and some catering establishments. The rescue operation there is ongoing at the moment. Really dramatic footage being published by the authorities there showing firefighters tackling the blaze. They think there might be people stuck in the rubble, so they're trying to rescue them.
And there's also been deaths reported in Donetsk as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In the eastern region of Donetsk, there was another missile strike at 5 a.m. this morning. The authorities, the regional authorities in Donetsk, said that they targeted private houses, so civilians that presumably were sleeping or maybe getting ready to start their day. There, three people were killed and three were injured.
And this all comes as Ukraine is continuing with its counteroffensive, which it launched just over a week ago. So it's got twin challenges here. It's trying to retake territory while trying to defend people in cities like Odessa.
Absolutely. In his evening address, President Zelensky said the fact that Russia was targeting civilians at the moment was a further reminder to its ally that Ukraine more than ever needed air defense systems, but also jets to be able to push back against Russian aggression from the air. And the British Defense Ministry, in its assessment of the war this morning, says that it believes that the reason why Russia's ramping up airstrikes at the moment over Ukraine is possibly because it's retaliating against this counteroffensive. Counteroffensive itself is progressing. We're getting conflicting reports from both sides, but certainly around the area of Bakhmut, the defense minister, Anna Malia, the Ukrainian defense minister, she says that troops there have gained about a couple of hundred meters. And this is something that's been corroborated by a Kremlin ally, Sergei Prigozhin. He says the Ukrainian forces liberated about 100 square kilometers of territory in Bakhmut. So that's where Ukrainian troops, that's one of the areas right now that they're trying to gain ground in.
Myeni Jones, we've been reporting in the past year on how millions of Ukrainians have become refugees. And more recently, we've also reported on how the conflict in Sudan has displaced more than a million people there. Now, as the United Nations' latest figures reveal that the number of refugees and displaced has reached an all-time high of 110 million people, the UN is calling for urgent action to help those who've been forced to flee their homes. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
War, violence or persecution, there are many reasons people flee their homes, but the overriding factor, the UN says, is a desperate search for peace and safety. Today, Filippo Grandi, the head of the UN Refugee Agency, lamented the record numbers.
We have 110 million people that have fled because of conflict, persecution, discrimination, violence, often mixed with other motives, in particular the impact of climate change. It's quite an indictment on the state of our world.
Driven by the war in Ukraine and the new conflict in Sudan, the numbers of displaced have risen by almost 10 million in just 12 months. Most refugees, more than 75%, seek safety close to home. Low- and middle-income countries host the most refugees, something the UN wants wealthy governments to keep in mind, in particular those like the United Kingdom, who are seeking to outsource refugees.
One thing we will never be able to agree to is that nobody is allowed to seek asylum in Europe, or in the United States, or in the United Kingdom. That door needs to remain open. To take asylum seekers from the UK and sending them to Rwanda, or, by the way, any other country, is not a good idea.
Faced with today's record numbers, the UN is appealing for unity to support refugees and funding to help them restart their lives in peace. But without an end to wars, new ones in Ukraine and Sudan, or old ones in Syria and Myanmar, people, ordinary families, will continue their search for safety.
Imogen Virks. As we record this podcast, the funeral is just starting of one of Europe's most colourful and controversial leaders of recent times, Silvio Berlusconi. Italy's former prime minister is being given a state funeral at Milan's Duomo Cathedral and the unprecedented honour of a national day of mourning. Thousands of people are attending, including political leaders and foreign dignitaries, but some opposition politicians have refused to go to the funeral. Our reporter, Sofia Bertizza, spoke to us from outside the cathedral.
In the last few hours, thousands of people have been gathering here in the main square to sort of say a final goodbye to Silvio Berlusconi. They have been clapping, waving Forza Italia flags, you know, that's the political party that Silvio Berlusconi created. They've also been waving AC Milan flags, which is the football team that Berlusconi owned for so many years. Some of them have been chanting, Silvio will always be our president. And of course, Milan is a city that is very close to Silvio Berlusconi. This is where he was born and this is where he started his career. And, you know, this whole thing is going to be a bit of a spectacle. There are two big maxi screens that have been set up in the square because the whole funeral will be televised. And also, interestingly, this will be a state funeral with military honours, which is something extraordinary. It's a treatment, an honour that is normally reserved for popes or for war heroes. So I think this gives you an idea of just how relevant Silvio Berlusconi was in this country.
And he's also getting a day of mourning in his honour, so that's proving quite controversial for some people.
That's right. So there are some members of the centre-left who have been criticising not so much the state funeral, but the National Day of Mourning. They say that, you know, this sort of tribute is inappropriate for Silvio Berlusconi, who was such a controversial figure. But despite of that, he does remain somebody very, very relevant here in Italy. And this does feel like the end of an era.
Sofia Bertizza in Milan at the state funeral of Silvio Berlusconi. Still to come, we hear how items belonging to the late Hollywood actor Paul Newman and his wife Joanne Woodward have sold for millions.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A teenage soldier who'd only recently joined the Japanese army has been arrested on suspicion of murder after three members of the army were shot at a firing range. Two of the soldiers died and a third was wounded. There are no reports of civilian casualties. A correspondent in Tokyo, Shami Khalil, told us that the shooting has shocked the country.
We understand that the victims were a man in his 50s and two others in their 20s. We understand that the shooter was a young, new recruit. He'd just been accepted as a candidate for the Ground Self-Defense Forces. What we don't know is why it happened. We don't really have any further information about the motive. But what was interesting, Janet, is, you know, I've been watching local media and most of the experts, the military experts on TV have been trying to explain what these shooting ranges, these firing ranges, look like and how they're handled. And they say they're very, very tightly controlled environments, and that it's not like guns are lying around. The recruits are given certain lanes. Everyone is in their lane. They're told to shoot at a target. These guns are carefully stored. They're locked and doubly locked. So there's still quite a bit of confusion and shock as to how this happened, especially given the fact that gun violence is extremely rare in Japan. Of course, this is a different context. It's a military context. This was a live fire training, but it's still shocking because it's happened in Japan.
This does come after a series of incidents that have been quite shocking and have rattled the country, including the assassination of the former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
If you remember, the perpetrator used a homemade gun in that assassination, in the incident, which tells you how difficult it is to get your hands on a gun in Japan. It's very, very strictly controlled. Civilians are only allowed to own hunting rifles or air guns, and you have to have licenses for those. And to do that, you have to go through, you know, a rigorous process of vetting, of tests, of mental health exams. So it becomes very, very difficult. But also it makes these shooting incidents quite shocking. A few months after the assassination of Shinzo Abe, you know, we were reporting on another shocking incident with the current Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, who was attacked by a smoke bomb. And a few weeks ago, I reported on an incident about a knife and a shooting attack in a town where two policemen were killed. And that's also very rare in Japan. So, of course, the regulation plays a huge part in this in Japan. And that's why gun violence, when it happens, it's very shocking for people in the country.
Shami Khalil, in the past month, more than 100 people have been killed and about 40,000 displaced in ethnic clashes in India's northeastern state of Manipur. Thousands of troops have been deployed there and mobile internet has been cut since last month. On Tuesday night, there was more violence. A top police official said at least 9 people had been killed in a gun battle near the state capital, Imphal. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasa Natarajan, told us more.
Security situation has been worsening in the state of Manipur for the past few weeks. These clashes between the communities, one, it is a Maithi community, which is the dominant in the valley, and then the tribes, mainly the Kuki ethnic tribe. These clashes have been happening for the past few weeks regarding the plans to give a special status to the Maithi community. That led to the violence. And the latest incident, one police officer was quoted as saying that militants attacked some of these villages and then some people from the village also fired back. That resulted in an exchange of gunfire that led to the casualties. Now, more police forces have been deployed to the area. It shows how the situation is volatile. The original clashes started in the first week of May. Despite thousands of troops being deployed in the state, sporadic violence is happening.
And the Maithi community is from the Hindu majority. We've heard a lot about the Hindu nationalist agenda of the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. What role is the Delhi government playing in all this?
See, the Maithi community says that the Kuki tribes are people coming from across the border in Myanmar. They are dominating, and then there are allegations of land grabbing by the ethnic tribes. Now, the state is ruled by the Hindu nationalist BJP. On the other side, the Kuki community, they have been talking about how they are Christians mainly. They are being forcefully evicted from the forest lands. Many of the churches have been burnt and they are being discriminated against by the Hindu nationalist BJP government. Now, the federal government rushed in the Home Minister, the Interior Minister, a couple of weeks ago. He held a meeting with various people for the past 10 days. But still, there is no peace. Both the communities are now refusing to join the peace community. And majority of the people in the state, they expect the Prime Minister Narendra Modi to speak about this, what is going on in Manipur, who has not visited the state and who has not commented about what has been happening. That has been a big disappointment for some of the representatives of the ethnic tribes.
Ambarasan Etirajan. An international police operation has dismantled a drugs ring that smuggled cocaine in surfboards from Uruguay to Europe. 3 Italians have been arrested, 2 in Portugal and 1 in Italy, on suspicion of being part of a trafficking group. The surfboards entered Europe via Spain, from where Guy Hedgeco sent this report.
Uruguayan police sniffer dogs signalled that there was something suspicious about 6 surfboards that were being sent to Europe. When opened, police found that the boards contained 50 kilos of cocaine. Five of the boards were seized, but the sixth was allowed to travel as planned, and police tracked it first to Spain and then Portugal. Portuguese police arrested the two Italian nationals who picked it up. Another suspect, also Italian, has been arrested in Uruguay.
Guy Hedgeco. For 50 years, the Oscar-winning actors Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward were the celebrity standard bearers for marriage, living proof that true love could succeed in Hollywood. It's been decades since their heyday. Newman died in 2008 and Woodward is now 93 and living with Alzheimer's. But their romance continues to captivate fans to this day. An auction of some of their belongings, memorabilia from the golden age of films to everyday household objects, has just racked up more than $4 million. Stephanie Prentice told us more about the sale.
Well, Jeanette, this was an absolutely huge auction. We're talking around 400 items belonging to the actor Paul Newman and his wife and former co-star Joanne Woodward. And they range from those big ticket items like watches to more sentimental things like a wedding dress or mementos from film sets. In fact, it included some shackles from the set of Cool Hand Luke and also a pocket watch. But even aside from those special things, auctioneers said even everyday items like a baseball cap that was listed at $100 or $200 ended up selling for around $900 each. Now, Paul Newman was known almost as much for his love of racing cars as his acting, and so a lot of items were related to that, including racing suits, some rings given as prizes for winning races, and a Rolex from when he became the oldest winner of the Daytona race. He was 70 years old, as well as another watch with "Drive Very Slowly" engraved in the back, and that was given to Paul from his wife Joanne. Now, Sotheby's Vice President Ian Ferreira de Bone described one of his favourite pieces, and we can take a quick listen.
One of the really special things in here is probably the thing that shines the least, but is the opera gloves. And so these are the gloves that Joanne was wearing when she won the Oscar for The Three Faces of Eve. And what's really interesting is that they were a total splurge for her. So she made her own dress that she wore to the Oscars, but this is what she spent the money on, was a pair of full-length kid gloves to go to the Oscars and actually win the award. So these gloves were holding the Oscar when she won it. So kind of an iconic moment of a burgeoning Hollywood career for Joanne.
So as we just heard there, people were buying little bits of Hollywood itself in this sale.
And with all this interest, what is it about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward that they still have so much appeal years and years after their Hollywood heyday?
Well, this was a couple that was married for 50 years and they were known and celebrated in the business for that close relationship. They met on a Broadway set of Picnic in 1953 and they made 15 films together over their careers. Now, when he was asked the secret to their success, Paul Newman famously said, "I've got steak at home, why should I go out for a hamburger?" And this marriage was really a bit of an industry fairy tale. They set up a home that's been described as shabby chic before shabby chic became a thing, and the auction included fun sort of thrift shop finds from their home, so a more intimate feel than some of these auctions that we usually see. Fans obviously responded well. There were nearly 6,600 bids placed by more than 800 bidders from more than 30 different countries.
Stephanie Prentice. Now, listen to this. That eerie melody is the sound of whale song, recorded 55 years ago by the celebrated marine biologist Roger Payne, whose death has been announced at the age of 88. His recordings, at a time when large-scale whale hunting was still common, have been credited with boosting conservation efforts as people realised how much they have in common with these vast mammals that roam the sea. In his final years, he mentored the filmmaker and author of How to Speak Whale, Tom Mustill. My colleague, Amal Rajan, spoke to him about Roger Payne's legacy.
I think his contribution was twofold. One, with whales, obviously he totally changed our perception of these animals that we were just slaughtering industrially in their hundreds of thousands. But the way he did that was not by appealing to the data. He was a scientist and his discoveries about whales made the front cover of Science. He did it by appealing to the heart. And it was by playing the songs of the whales to people that it changed our perceptions of them and led in great part to the end of industrialised whaling. And this was really the first great environmental success story from the Save the Whales movement. Greenpeace and other environmental organisations were launched. And so I think for almost every conservation biologist, what we've learned from this is that it's not data that drives change in people, it's emotion and connection.
I can see that it's hard to talk about someone that you were very close to. What was he like as a friend and mentor?
He was just great fun. although he dealt with such gloomy things like extinction, he was just a kind listener. Maybe I just spoke to his wife last night, and just before he died, he was surrounded by his family, eating a giant lemon cake, singing together, and discussing the dynamics of hummingbird flight. And it's just these streams of curiosity and music that you felt when you were with him, and he just was just a great encourager of enthusiasm.
Well, let's hear one of those streams. This is Payne, in his own words, reflecting on how we should listen to Whale Song in one of the conversations he recorded with you.
How should you listen to Whale Song?
Attentively. You should listen silently. You should listen with nothing else to distract you. That's the way to listen.
Well, his final essay, Tom, was published in Time magazine last week, and it was this rumination on the sort of illusions of scale in nature. So he argued that we're moved by the awesome magnitude of whales, these enormous champions of the sea, but that almost tricks us into thinking that they matter more than plankton, whereas one of the lessons of his life was that each species has a vital role, even if we haven't discovered the species yet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very important when you think about this to cast your mind back to when he started in the 60s. People didn't care about whales then. They thought they were just these big, stupid fish that lived in the sea. You know, it took Roger playing their songs for us to identify with them and emotionally connect, you know, sort of think about them as worth protecting.
Tom Mustill talking about the work and the legacy of marine biologist Roger Payne. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Gareth Jones. The producer was Nisha Patel. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.